morning and welcome to this month's Hancock & Whitney Bank's Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to david.lundgren@hancockbank.com and he'll take the questions at the end of the call. Today we have John Portwood, Chief Investment Officer, David Lundgren, Investment Director, Greg Hudlewski, Investment Director, and Jeff Tangus, Investment Director. Now I'll pass the call to David Lundgren, who will be the moderator.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Thanks for once again joining us for our monthly economic update call. And John, I think best place to start will be to talk about the economy here in the U.S. During the month, second quarter GDP was reported, and it was up 1.7% for the second quarter. I think that was a bit better than expected. We have two more revisions to go on that number. And then we got the final reading on first quarter, and that, however, was revised downward a bit, 1.1%, nothing overly exciting, more just kind of below trend line growth. Give us your thoughts on the health of the economy and where you think we're headed going forward.
Okay, Dave, let's look first at what the leading indicators are doing. We've got data, of course, that looking backward, and that may be revised a bit. But anyway, what do the leading indicators say? The leading indicators still suggest we're in an expansion. There's no indication that a recession is imminent. That's really been the case for the leading indicator group ever since the recession bottomed in 2009. We've had a few instances where the leading indicators weakened enough to suggest that there just might be a recession on the horizon, but those periods were very brief, and overall it looks like we're still in that same environment where the leading indicators suggest the expansion should continue. Getting back to the real GDP numbers, probably it's a good idea to look at the longer-term picture that exists to date coming from the recession. GDP growth, real GDP growth, has been less than 2% annualized since the recession, much weaker than normal when you look at all of the recoveries from recessions we've had since World War II. The year-over-year number, based on the latest data, is only 1.43%. Historically, a number that low has been sort of a recession precursor because it indicated a very stagnant economy that was probably teetering on the edge of a new recession. But, of course, the leading indicators don't suggest that's about to happen. So what have we got here? It looks like we're still in a 2% plus or minus GDP world, which is something we speculated about for some time, ever since the 2009 recession. And when you look back at the late 1990s and come forward, you see a fairly distinct step down over time in economic activity that the economists are just now beginning to look at and trying to figure out what caused this step down beginning in the late 1990s. Obviously it hasn't all been due to the great crash and the great recession, but something's been amiss, I guess, or afoot to produce that kind of pattern. And it looks like that is probably continuing. Obviously, we've got headwinds. We've had a lot of headwinds developing since the great crash. Demographics are not favorable. We've got a decline in the working age population and a continual rise in the dependency ratio. More people are retiring than we've had in quite a few years, and it's going to require more workers to support each retiree. So that's something of an economic headwind. We still got too much debt. Private debt has been worked off to some degree, but there's really too much government debt, and there appears to be a very distinct relationship between the level of government debt and GDP growth. So that's certainly a concern and a headwind. And then, of course, we have continuing government intervention with regulations and so forth that obviously don't add to GDP growth and probably produce constraints of some sort. So if we are in a 2% world, it's going to continue for a while, and the odds seem to suggest that that probably is the case. You know, how long might it last? If you look back at the history of economies after they have experienced a massive credit bust like the one we had, it takes upward of 8 to 10 years, I guess, to try to work through this. And if you use that 10-year guideline as a as an estimate, it means maybe we've got 4 or 5 years to go before we come out of it, just looking at history. There are other economists who argue that given the long-term changes in demographics and other factors and the rise in the dependency ratio, and that's true both here and in Europe, that it could be this 2% GDP growth that we're seeing now is really the norm for maybe, you know, quite a long period of time, and that, you know, achieving consistent GDP growth of over 3%, which everybody would like to see, of course, you know, might not really be possible. And these things, of course, we don't know for sure. We'll just have to wait and see. But at least for the time being, it looks like we're still in this relatively, compared to the past, you know, weak GDP environment with, you know, a reasonable guess being, I guess, 2% going forward.
Now, I know a lot of economists are, I've seen a few of them where they're projecting a pretty strong second half of the year. I've seen a few with the number 3% is what they're expecting in the second half. Do you feel that that's a realistic possibility? I mean, are we looking at a stronger second half?
My guess would be probably not. Although the, you know, a stronger coming half, whether it was the first half or the second half, has sort of been anticipated by economists ever since the Great Recession. You know, everybody has said, well, the next year or the next 6 months, we're going to, you know, see the breakout and the return to 3% GDP growth, and it has never occurred. So far, the forecasts have been pretty far off the mark, and I guess anything is possible, but when you add up all of the current data, you know, it looks like that might be kind of a stretch.
It's on the high end.
Yeah, it's probably on the high end. Coincident data, though, is still pretty good. I mean, you look at the coincident economic data, again, it sort of supports the idea, you know, put forward by the leading indicators that we're not about to have a recession. But it's kind of hard to imagine, you know, a lot of acceleration in the second half.
Okay. I guess, you know, in talking about some good news on the economic front, you know, we're going to talk about the Fed in a minute, but, you know, one of their goals is to reduce the level of unemployment, and the last unemployment rate came in at 7.4%, and that was the lowest since 2008. Also, initial jobless claims were 326,000. That's also lowest since 2008. So these are, I guess, two positive developments. But I know that sometimes there's some noise in those numbers. Give us your thoughts on the jobs number.
The good news from an employment standpoint, if you look at an index of employment gains or losses over time, and in particular employment gains and losses during the Great Recession and to date, you see a pretty continuous increase. In other words, it's almost like a ruler. Unfortunately, it's growing very slowly.
Right.
You know, it's the worst, you know, jobs recovery since a recession, since World War II. You've got to go back to the 1930s to see anything comparable. So, you know, all of the excitement and angst that we see around every jobs announcement hasn't really changed that advancing line at all. So it's really kind of interesting. You can put a ruler on it, and it's just as straight as it can be. Looking at percent job gains since the recession, it's just very, very slow. Unfortunately, when you tear the employment numbers apart, you find that since the Great Recession, the lower quality jobs in terms of incomes and the part-time jobs have been rising faster than full-time jobs and the higher-paying jobs. So there's a divide there that we haven't seen in quite some time, and that appears to be continuing. For the last quarter, for example, I think if I remember the numbers correctly, three-quarters of the jobs created were part-time relative to full-time jobs. So, you know, obviously, you know, to the extent that continues, you know, it's going to be again, I guess, another headwind for the economy because of the consumption that there are, I guess, the lack of consumption on the part of the, you know, employed folks might suggest. Consumer income, if adjusted for inflation, has been declining since 2000. So, you know, wage gains haven't really kept up with inflation. That's you know, something of a negative. So, again, it's kind of like the GDP numbers. You know, it's getting better, but it's not getting better very fast. And the quality of the jobs is not as good as it should be. So, you know, to what extent that, you know, lasts a few more years or whether it's structural, there's still a lot of argument going on about that. So we'll just have to wait and see. There probably are structural elements, I would imagine. One thing that one economist brought out recently about the jobs picture was that 1 million jobs in the 34 full-time jobs in the 35 to 54-year-old group has been lost since the Great Recession, and those are the real GDP drivers in the economy. The economists think that that group is the one that really, you know, does all the entrepreneurial activity and really drives the economy, the investment, the saving, and everything else. And if you've got a million fewer jobs in that age group, then that suggests that, you know, we're still probably in a relatively, you know, tepid recovery environment and, you know, relatively slow employment growth environment.
Okay. Thanks. Greg, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, great month for the S&P 500. Got back to its winning ways. The S&P 500 was up 5.1% for the month of July, and that brings the year-to-date return to almost 20%. Small cap stocks also did really well, as represented by the Russell 2000. They were up 7% and are now up 24% year-to-date. So really just an amazing run. I guess that my question, you know, these numbers, you've heard John talk about, I guess, you know, I wouldn't say exciting GDP growth or jobs numbers. You know, it could be worse, but, you know, nothing really strong. So it doesn't really seem to match up to what's happening in the stock market. What do you think's going on?
No, I agree. I recently did a presentation that I titled The Economy Stinks, But the Market Doesn't Care, which is, I think, a headline I ripped off from a FNBC, or I mean a CNBC headline. But you're right. I mean, it's hard to find a legitimate or fundamental reason on why stocks continue to go up. You know, a lot of things are out there. One, Fed easy money. That's a theory, you know, that we've talked about in past discussions. There is some statistical basis that when interest rates are low, there's what we call an inverse or opposite relationship between PEs, meaning that when interest rates are high, PEs tend to be low, and vice versa. When interest rates are low, PEs tend to be on the higher side. There certainly is that second half recovery story that John alluded to. It just seems like we go from year to year going, all right, it's going to be stronger, it's going to be stronger. And again, here we are past the midpoint of 2013, and it just doesn't seem to be the case. And then there's always TINA, that there is no alternative. When you can't make any money in cash, you can't make any money in the bond market or very little, and stocks seem to be the only place. Well, that would also argue that money is flowing into the stock market and helping push it up. I think I do give a lot of legitimacy that, you know, the Fed, for one reason or another, whether their liquidity program is designed to stimulate the economy so far, I think the results, I think many people would agree, have been rather tepid because we just aren't seeing the kind of growth we would expect or recovery, the speed of the recovery. If it's propping up, or if one of their goals is to prop up the stock market to kind of provide a wealth effect, which then presumably trickles down to the consumer, and then the consumer begins to spend, which again is about two-thirds of GDP, that doesn't seem to be happening either. And the jobs rate, again, going back to what John said, it's just part-time. And also I think one of the quirkier calculations is that a lot of people drop off those roles in what they call the participation rate. So we're seeing reductions in unemployment, but it's not necessarily because jobs are being created, but because people have stopped looking for work. So I think bottom line, I mean, if you look at some of the earnings results, at the end of June, the earnings growth rate basically for companies in the S&P was at 0.6%, and that was primarily, I think, led by financials. Of the 393 companies that have reported earnings to date for Q2 2013 as of today, 73% have reported earnings above their mean estimate, which is a good number. So, you know, maybe there's some light there that maybe earnings are picking up. Still, if you're looking at the, and then another 55%, I should say, have reported earnings above their mean estimate on the revenue side. But still, if you look at that percentage change, that's 1.7% growth rate. So, still historically a bit anemic, particularly to support the kind of growth that we're seeing in the stock market. You know, I do see small caps, as you pointed out, were incredibly strong. And typically, again, when you come out of a recession, small caps tend to be highly leveraged to the economy, and so they tend to go up more. So, you know, perhaps, again, the market is a discounting mechanism. It is looking forward. Perhaps it sees something that we don't, or maybe it's just hope, although I've always argued that hope is not a strategy. But one of the interesting statistics that I read this morning, and this is from a firm called Cornerstone Macro, they did a little analysis, and they said that really most of the drive or most of the pressure that's pulled the S&P up, which were roughly up about 300 points year-to-date from the beginning of the year, multiple expansion, that's the PE multiple, has actually expanded, and that has been the driver to most of the market increases. According to their analysis, roughly 200 points of the S&P's rally this year has been due to multiple expansion, while earnings per share growth has only explained about 68 points. So that's really kind of interesting. It's not the earnings that are driving it, but rather the valuations. And that can go back again to the PE versus interest rate relationship. In any event, I think in the short term, I think the risks to the market are probably in September. I think a lot of credence can be led to the Fed, again, when they started talking about tapering or essentially turning off that liquidity faucet back in June, we saw the market sell off. And they quickly backed off that and became a little bit more softer, and that indicated that they wouldn't just shut the tap off. So in September, they're going to talk about that again, so it'll be interesting to see what the market reaction is or how they've modified their language to perhaps not disrupt markets as much. But it seems to me that, you know, they also understand we can't keep this liquidity pump going on and with dubious benefit, I guess, for the economy. So it'll be interesting to see. According to, again, just to finish up on this particular firm's reasons for why we're having the multiple expansion, they think the three drivers basically are, one, a stronger dollar, which has to do more with weakness in China, our improving budget deficit, and again, the weakness in China, which continues, and that should help drive up PE multiples. The one dangerous thing there also, of course, is that if earnings don't recover, then your PE multiples can get way too high, and then you certainly will find yourself in a way overvalued situation.
All right, Greg, thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Hey, Jeff, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Dave.
Well, you heard Greg. He kind of touched on your topic here. I guess, you know, during the quarter, or really during the month, a lot of the market talk was in regards to, is the Fed going to taper? If, when, how much? I guess first, maybe explain to our listeners what we're talking about when we're talking about tapering.
Right.
And then, give us your thoughts on what do you think is going to happen.
Sure.
And what the impact will be.
Well, as we all know, the Fed has taken a lot of unconventional steps in this recovery to try to improve the unemployment situation to generate jobs. Of course, they have a dual mandate to create jobs in the economy and to limit inflation. But one of the tools that they've employed was what they refer to as the quantitative easing, which is essentially them going out into the marketplace and buying bonds, typically U.S. Treasury bonds, out on the longer end to try to force down longer-term interest rates. The old more demand means lower interest rates on bonds. So they were trying to create that demand and force interest rates down. The thinking being lower interest rates will help the housing market and get the economy going. So that's been the plan. They've been doing that. They've been buying an enormous amount, $85 billion a month, essentially, in treasuries, as well as mortgage-backed type securities. So it's a program that has been somewhat controversial in that nobody is really clear if it's really doing good or if it is doing good, how much good is it really doing, and it certainly comes at a cost. The discussion, the tapering term, is actually the discussion of their exit from that particular program. For example, this month they buy $85 billion, next month they buy $65 billion, the month after that they buy $55 billion or $45 billion, and they taper the size of those purchases over a period of time to gradually exit out of that program. And the market, the question has never been whether they will ever stop quantitative easing. Everybody knows that it couldn't go on forever. The question would be, when would they stop, and how quickly would they withdraw from the market? Those are the two big issues. So the tapering, after a Fed meeting back in May, the Fed alluded to perhaps starting to reduce some of those monthly purchases under that quantitative easing program. And the market sort of forecasted, looking at the calendar of Fed meetings, that they would likely start that in September. And, of course, the bond market is hypersensitive to anything that the Fed does. And the fact that the Fed would be pulling back was a big concern, and that caused some concern among investors. And that's when we saw a 10-year Treasury rate go from about 1.6% to where it is today, which is about 2.6%, all based on the notion that the Fed is starting to exit some of their stimulus programs, and that would ultimately lead to higher rates. The other thing contributing to those higher rates, of course, has been somewhat better economic news, although we would probably argue not great news, but certainly maybe a little bit better. So the Fed's been very busy. They were quite surprised at the market's reaction back in May when it first mentioned the word of tapering, and they saw the dramatic rise in interest rates. It concerned them. I've always argued that the Fed starting to plan on their tapering program, not because the economy was doing so great, but more likely that because the program itself really wasn't doing any good, there was a cost involved to it, but that the benefits really weren't that great. So that's a debate that's out there, but for whatever reason, the Fed has talked more about tapering. More recently, they've actually tried to walk it back a little bit because I think they were concerned that it was creating too much chaos in the market. As a matter of fact, the Fed met July 31st and came out with a surprisingly dovish statement, which means that they would be more accommodative longer than people were were anticipating. One of the voting members of the FOMC, the Open Market Committee, Charles Evans from Chicago, said he really wanted to see 6 months of consistent job growth over 200,000 per month before he really thought it would be warranted to exit some of the stimulus programs. So there's still a considerable amount of debate on the Fed as to when and how quickly they will exit from this particular quantitative easing program of buying $85 billion a month. But there really is no doubt about the fact that they will exit because it can't go on forever. It's just a question of when, not if. But it's important to note, though, that that the tapering program is not what we would call tightening, which is a different mentality. I guess from an analogy would be if you're driving your car down the road, tapering might be taking your foot off the gas a little bit. Tightening would actually be putting your foot on the brake. And so what they're doing is just sort of gradually trying to move out of this particular program so that the economy can once again stand on its own 2 feet. So we'll just have to watch and see. The latest thinking is really that the Fed will likely, they could start in September, but at this point it's looking more like December before they start this. So look for more gyrations out of the market as that becomes more of less speculation and more certainty.
Jeff, you talked a little bit about bond yields, and we saw this big jump in yields. I guess that was in the month of June, and a lot of it related to, potential tapering by the Fed. And I guess for really, a good month now, we've kind of stayed in that 2.5% to 2.6% range. Where do you think we go for the remainder of the year? And I know a lot of it's going to be dependent on what you just talked about, what the Fed actually does versus what the talk is, but give us some insight on that.
Well, yeah, it is going to be dependent upon how quickly the Fed moves and a lot on the economic numbers that especially employment numbers that get released between now and year end. And John talked about what we see there. We basically don't see anything spectacular. That would lead us to believe that rates generally will remain stable. There seems to be an equilibrium point right around this, as you say, this 2.5% to 2.6% level on bonds. If the economy shows a little extra strength, the conventional wisdom out there is that you could easily see a 3% 10-year treasury, which is modestly higher from where we are right now. With less Federal Reserve intervention and an economy that's modestly improving, and that number comes essentially out of where the rate of inflation is running these days, which is fairly modest. It's something a little less than 2%, maybe, and then you add on premium, which you normally do for a 10-year. So generally speaking, the market has found a level here that it seems to be pretty comfortable with, but we could very well see rates drifting higher as the economy shows some improvement. So stay tuned on that. Certainly nothing like the gyrations we saw back in May and June, but an improving economy generally will lead to rates that drift higher. Outside of the Treasury market, there's actually been a couple things that have taken place I'll point to real quickly, and that is it looks like Congress and the President is actually speaking today on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, what they're going to do with those two big entities. They're really trying to wind them down. Most everybody agrees that we need to get rid of them as they formerly existed. They were just too much, too big of the market, too much risk concentrated there. The government will ultimately take a secondary and more of a catastrophic risk rather than the first risk that they took here. So look for more developments there, but they can't do anything real quickly because Fannie and Freddie are still issuing probably about 80% of the mortgages in the housing market right now. Beyond that, corporate bonds, which, of course, we're a big investor in, saw a little bit of a sell-off after the big Fed news back in May, and what we've seen since then is spreads starting to tighten back up. So the corporate market has been outperforming here recently. So been a lot of moving parts in the bond markets over the last month, but essentially things are starting to settle down from where they were a couple months ago.
Okay. Jeff, one last question here before we wrap up. I guess it was early July, City of Detroit declared bankruptcy. How does that affect the muni market? Is that kind of viewed as a one-off, or do we potentially see a lot more cities and municipalities having similar issues?
Well, Detroit was a one-off in that it's been a declining situation really since the 60s. They tied their fortunes to the American automobile industry, which, as we all know, has been on the decline until at least of late, when things have started to improve somewhat. The Detroit bankruptcy was a surprise to absolutely no one anywhere. Everybody knew this was inevitable. It was just a question of when. So that part of it wasn't much of a surprise. What everybody was wanting to see is whether there would be a contagion effect into other cities and other general obligation bonds, which so far we haven't really seen. Looks like the bankruptcy will take about a year or so to work through. What is interesting about this is that from their perspective, it's really not the debt that's the problem with Detroit. Well, the first problem really is the population decline. They don't have the people. They've gone from about 1.8 million people in 1950 to about 700. So they've got a lot less people, which means a lot more empty houses and empty buildings. They've got about 70,000 vacant structures there that have to be torn down some way or another. But the real big problem is the pension benefits and the health benefits promised to retirees that they have just not set money aside. And that's the lion's share of their issue, their problem. It's not so much the debt. But it all gets thrown into the same hopper when you go into bankruptcy. So the whole world is watching to see how the pension and health benefits to retirees will be handled in the bankruptcy, because cities and counties around the country are all experiencing that same pressure from those types of benefits that have been promised over the years, but money has really not been set aside to pay them. So that's why this is really an important issue, and we'll be watching it closely.
All right. Thank you very much for everybody for joining us. Look forward to talking to you next month. Thank you.